From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utah does have hate crimes laws, a few of them, actually. But supporters of a new hate crimes bill making its way through the legislature this year say those laws protect no one. For 20 years now, there have been more than 1,200 official reports of hate crimes in this state, crimes that victims said were motivated by their race or sexual orientation. 1,200, yet not one prosecution. The new bill aims to fix that, to put some teeth into the law. But opponents of the bill, including apparently the LDS Church, say any tinkering with the law could upset a delicate balance the state has settled into between the rights of the LGBT community and the rights of religious people. Today in the program, we're talking about the hate crimes debate, what these laws are supposed to prevent, and whether or not they actually do. Join us after the news. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio. You're listening to Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and by its listeners. You can help support this free service by becoming a member at KUER.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last year, it was pretty extraordinary when lawmakers managed to pass legislation protecting Utah's LGBT community from housing and employment discrimination. And most everyone agrees that probably wouldn't have happened without the support from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. LDS leaders worked pretty closely with activists and lawmakers on the legislation that some have described as having struck this balance between gay rights and religious liberty. But now, a new hate crimes bill being proposed by Republican State Senator Stephen Urquhart is causing some unease. Opponents of the bill, including apparently the LDS Church, say a hate crimes bill may throw off this equilibrium. Last week, the church issued a statement saying as much. It's hard to say what effect that will have on the bill, but let's be honest, the church exerts a lot of influence. Supporters of the bill say the hate crimes provisions on the books in this state already don't really protect anyone, so they're trying to add tougher criminal penalties for those who target people for crimes based on certain biases, like race and gender and national origin and, crucially, sexual orientation. So today in the program, we are talking about this debate, and we're going to begin with the bill's sponsor, Stephen Urquhart, Republican representing Washington County's District 29 in the state Senate. As I said, he's the sponsor of the bill, and he's joining us from the Senate offices in the Capitol this morning. And Senator Urquhart, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Doug. Great to be with you.
I wanted to begin by asking you, what's the problem you were trying to fix with your bill?
44 states have effective hate crime legislation. We do not. Criminally, we punish an act and an intent. And so with hate crimes, that's an attempt to truly punish the intent. So, for example, if someone paints a smiley face on a synagogue, the intent there is to make graffiti. If someone paints a swastika on there, then quite likely the intent is not only to put graffiti on the synagogue, it's also to terrorize the Jewish community. So if that additional intent can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, then there should be a one-level enhancement for that crime.
Why don't we have more teeth on those? I mean, if you were to boil it down, essentially, why? What's the problem with imposing these tougher penalties? If you can distill it down,
well, there isn't a problem. You mean the problem with the Mormon Church, or
no? What I mean is, why hasn't the state proposed legislation with tougher penalties? What's been the principal sticking point, obstacle, do you think? I guess that's how I want to put it.
Well, we did pass something. David Litvak, he ran it, I believe it was 2007, and we have something on the books, but our Utah appellate court told us that it is not effective. It will not punish hate crimes.
I wanted to get to this really critical point. Of the more than 1,200 official reports of hate crimes in the last 20-some-odd years, there have been no prosecutions, not one. That sort of gets to your point, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, we have something on the books that nominally says hate crimes, but, it's a toothless tiger. You know, and the interesting thing is the Mormon Church has supported all those prior efforts, and so— you know, based on that and based on last year's passage of non-discrimination legislation, to me it just seemed like a clear logical step to extend those protections for all Utahns to our criminal code. And I was just shocked that without talking to me, they droned my bill from 30,000 feet.
You were pretty candid and really frank in your criticism of the LDS Church's involvement on the issue. In essence, you said this. You said that the proper legislative process had basically been subverted by the church's interference. Now, that's my word, but is that a fair assessment, that the process was subverted by their statement last week?
No, it's 100% accurate. I mean, and let me say, I'm very proud of the Mormon Church. I think it's a great and important part of the fabric of our state. And typically, it handles itself professionally, and it is respectful of the democratic process. But here, it just wasn't. I don't know how to explain that. Maybe it at some point will decide to explain its involvement in the political arena on this one. But to never talk with me and to have this foreshadowed or foretold by Gail Ruzicka at committee hearing, that's just bizarre.
Wait, what do you mean? So they knew that we're talking about the Utah's Eagle Forum, Gail Ruzicka. You're saying that opponents like Gail Ruzicka knew this was coming before you did?
Yeah, I mean, that was the first I heard of it, was in committee. Gail testified, and she said that there was an agreement last year that the church would support housing and employment protections for all Utahns if the LGBT community agreed to, or I guess if legislators agreed to keep the LGBT community in a box. And so I said, look, I was the bill sponsor and I didn't make any such agreement. And so she cryptically said that I wasn't the only person involved in this. And then it passed out of committee 5-1.
Right.
It clearly was going to pass the Senate. And then a couple days later, the church came out with its statement that, yeah, in your intro, you said it's hard to say what effect the church's statement will have on the legislation. To me, it's not hard at all. The legislation's dead now.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, hopefully we can bring it back next year. But the church, it wields phenomenal power up here.
Yeah.
It's no secret. Everyone knows it. And for them to wield it in this way without ever talking to me, it's just bizarre. I've been up here 16 years and I haven't seen that. So, you know, it really sours what happened last year. They talk about, you know, a sweet spirit and balance and all of that. Well, where did it go? Because I think that what most Utahns thought happened last year is we were going to extend the protections of our laws to all Utahns. And that seems to be the spirit that died with their press release. And, you know, the whole balance thing, I don't know what that means, because my bill, it protects in the exact same way religion and sexual orientation.
One of the things that concerned, for example, your colleague, Senator Mark Madsen, in his sort of dispute with the LDS Church over his medical marijuana bill, is that at least initially, church representatives were pretty vague in their statements. And it sounds like you have the same kinds of concerns. You're not entirely clear what exactly they're troubled by, I guess. They're not being specific, I suppose. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, they talk about a need for balance. Again, my legislation is perfectly balanced, religion, sexual orientation. So are they talking about a balance between something that would further civil rights versus bills on the other side, which call for genital inspection before transgender individuals use the bathroom? Or are they talking about LaVar's bills that would ignore the Constitution and the Obergefell decision? I mean, there's no moral equivalency between those two. So as far as I can tell, given their past support of hate crimes legislation, this is simply an issue of sexual orientation, gender identity being added. I think that somehow they construe the fact that they joined the party last year, you know, came on board as the last part of the coalition, mm-hmm. gives the church veto rights over what will be doled out to the LGBT community in the state. And that's there are problems with that. That should not be a church's role.
So I'm trying to figure out what the church is trying to express, whether explicitly or not. Are they saying that as far as they're concerned, this is pretty much as far as we're willing to go in the matter of LGBT rights? Or do you think it's one of the things, that it's an expression in some way of their concern, and I know they're concerned, you do too, about religious liberty. Can you figure that out?
Well, this can't be religious liberty, because again, if you want to protect religion from hate crime, then my bill passes. You know, you have, there's a case where Mormon churches were being set on fire,
yeah.
A clear hate crime. It couldn't be prosecuted as one. So if you want to protect religious liberties, then you do it in my bill. And so unless it means that there needs to be some sort of deal where religious liberties, you know, they advance two steps for every one step that LGBT rights progress. But again, it's just to leverage these two issues, that the church now is going to assume a position where LGBT rights cannot advance without its blessing, without those rights being held hostage to something that the church feels will promote religious liberties. It's vulgar. It's offensive to the democratic process.
In that press release, church officials mentioned the term Utah Compromise, that there had been this historic compromise when lawmakers passed that anti-discrimination law last year. And you're essentially saying, don't even use that word anymore, Utah Compromise. I mean, in fact, you say you've kind of come to reject it now. Explain what you mean. Essentially, what you're saying is that their involvement now makes sort of hollow this idea of compromise that happened last year?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, compromise means people are coming together to move things forward. And for the church now to act like what happened last year gives it dictatorial authority over LGBT rights, it's a gross distortion of what happened last year. I mean, again, this was a broad coalition that had formed over decades, and the church was absolutely the last one to join that coalition. And I won't use the term Utah Compromise anymore, because this seems to be something that the church did to leverage it's been losing the cultural war on this issue. Mm-hmm. So maybe it seems like it gave ground on this one so that it could, have unilateral control in the future. I mean, so now to me, the Utah Compromise, it kind of rings like the Missouri Compromise, which in our nation's history, you had a political deal where it was treated as morally equivalent, the demands of those people who wanted to own other people and those who thought that was morally abhorrent, where as long as both sides were advanced, a series of failed presidents could act like could believe that they did something worthwhile. And so if the Utah Compromise is now going to hold hostage LGBT rights, then the term has been significantly bastardized.
You know, I often wonder how lawmakers who find themselves in disagreement with their church over a piece of legislation, like you, how they describe that predicament. I mean, if you make a distinction between the church's, you know, temporal interests and their spiritual goals, it seems like you're in that predicament. I mean, how are you thinking about it? The church has been really involved this year, it seems. I'm not sure if it's unprecedented, but it seems to be, from your perspective, it has been. So their sort of temporal interests and their spiritual goals, is there a difference between those? I mean, how are you sort of thinking about this now?
Yeah, there's a huge difference. I mean, here they clearly waded into the political fray, and anyone who's into the political fray, it's a rough and tumble world. And so, any entity that's going to deep six one of my bills without talking to me, it's my job to point out that it's inappropriate. It's my job to push for this legislation. You know, and it's not a comfortable position. It's not a position I like. I revere the Mormon Church. It's been great in my life. When Ralph Becker was running for mayor 8 years ago, I was the first Republican office holder to endorse him. And I had one question for him. I said, Ralph, are you going to be a jerk to the Mormon Church? And I said, if you are, then I don't want anything to do with you. And I think that it is such an important, vital part of our state, and typically I'm just really proud of how it conducts itself, but in this matter, in this session, it's just acting far beneath its past practice and far beneath its wonderful potential.
You ever think, Senator, do you ever feel disloyal? I mean, do you ever feel like you're in a moral conflict with the church, for example? I mean, they say time and time again, they're only going to get involved when there's a moral issue at stake. So do you feel like you're at odds with something larger in that sense when you're in dispute with the church like you are right now?
Great question. I think that, you know, some of my colleagues, some of my constituents view that. And to me, this is just politics. I've been doing politics for 16 years. And, you know, when the church fully wades into a political issue, then, you know, it's in the fray. It's in the arena. You know, and I'll tell you why that's a super interesting question is you hear what the church claims to be persecution, religious persecution, and the liberties that it's fighting for. A lot of that has to do with, a lot of the examples that Elder Oaks used in the press conference last year, that wasn't religious persecution. That was the church acting in a political way and people reacting to it. Mm-hmm. And so anytime you're in the political arena and you say something, you take a position, well, that's the way the process works. People are going to come back and point out that maybe you're wrong, maybe that you're thuggish in this. So if it doesn't want that kind of reaction, it needs to stay out of the political arena.
One more quick question. I think you already answered it, but there is going to be a vote at least. I guess you're counting votes. Do you think it's dead for this year?
Yeah, I mean, clearly it would have passed. I mean, I've been working the floor. I know how to count votes, but now you know, I need 15 votes. I'm at 10 with 7 I consider still in play, and it's going to be awfully tough to run the table and grab 5 of those. And it's just a shame. I mean, this is something where we would have had great debate. It's such a logical follow-up to what we did last year, and to just have the discussion snuffed out by a press release that doesn't even make sense, it's just offensive to democratic process.
That's State Senator Stephen Urquhart, who represents Washington County's District 29, joined us from the Capitol. Senator, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're discussing a hate crimes bill at the Utah legislature. The idea of the legislation is to impose more rigorous penalties for people who target victims because of certain biases. Race, of course, and religion and sexual orientation seems to be the part that has always been controversial in bills like these. So we're talking about it today. We had on the program with us earlier Stephen Urquhart, who's the sponsor of the bill. That's Senate Bill 107. Joined us from the Capitol. Joining us now is Derek Monson, who is Director of Public Policy for the Sutherland Institute. It's a conservative think tank based in Salt Lake City. And we should say he wrote an op-ed piece against the legislation for the Salt Lake Tribune. The Sutherland Institute is opposing the bill, obviously, on the Hill. Derek Monson, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks.
I want to begin and by just making it clear, you do not speak for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day
yes,
Saints.
Yes, that's correct.
But something came up with Senator Urquhart, and I wanted to get your opinion on it, that the church, he doesn't dispute the fact that they have a right to express themselves in whatever they want. But by issuing a statement like that with a bill that was clearly, at least from his perspective, on its way to passing, subverted the legislative process. What do you say to that?
Well, I don't know how you can subvert the legislative process by participating in it. You know, I mean, lots of groups make statements and lots of groups have opinions. And so that is the legislative process in my mind. And so I guess what it sounds to me like is his bill didn't pass, and so that's how he wants to characterize it. And that's fine. I mean, we understand that feeling of frustration, you know, but I just don't think it's accurate.
In your op-ed piece for the Tribune, you said that this legislation, that Senator Urquhart's bill, is designed to turn back the clock. What do you mean?
Well, you know, I think the Utah Compromise was about two things primarily. It had two elements to it. One was a policy element, clearly, because it's talking about the law.
Right.
And the other was a political element, trying to create an what an understanding and an impression and a perception that we can work together on this stuff to balance religious liberty and gay rights. And so for us, part of that, a big part of it, really, was having the whole package deal. You know, the main bill was SB 296, obviously. But there was another bill that made the whole thing possible that was more focused on religious liberty, SB 297, you know, dealing with county clerks. And so what we mean when we say turning back the clock in that context is we're trying to go back to kind of one-side-focused legislation that might have certainly elements for the other side, but it doesn't really embrace the full concept of we're going to make sure that we have things the LGBT community really is concerned about, reflects their life, their realities, and then we're going to have things that the religious community is really focused on and really reflects the majority of the religious community's life and concerns and issues. And so we think SB 107 on its own doesn't meet that standard. And so it kind of goes back to that old way of doing things of we're only going to focus on one side primarily.
In your piece, you write that hate crimes legislation, and I'm going to quote you here, should include specific and substantive protections for religious liberty that actually reflect the problems faced in real life by religious believers.
Right.
Start with that last part, the problems faced in real life by religious believers. What does that mean? What are the problems? And be specific, if you would.
Sure, yeah. Well, I think you see in a lot of different news stories across the country over the, you know, you can go back years. And if you want to go back a few years, an example would be student groups on campuses that are religious in nature. You know, I think there was in California a religious legal society, a Christian legal society. And they were denied equal access to funds and facilities that most student groups get because they want their leadership to adhere to what is, in essence, an honor code, you know, to adhere to the sexual morals of the Christian faith. And the court said that was it was okay for universities to call that discriminatory. And so I think that's something that Christian students, for example, that's an everyday reality that they face. I think you could look at universities generally. This is an example of BYU is having to think about, I guess. They aren't necessarily dealing with it yet, but they could. And that's that there's been calls to have their law school's accreditation revoked because of the honor code that they want to maintain for the people who attend that school who are members of the faith going in. And again, that's something I think that a lot of at least folks in the LDS community would be concerned about. I don't think that they're terribly concerned about, at least in the LDS context, so, and then we can address the Jewish context, so that's different. But in the LDS context, I'm not sure that hate crimes are really a huge issue, at least here in Utah. I know there's examples that have been brought up of chapels being burned and things like that. But
Senator Court mentioned that,
by the way. Yeah. And those are obviously real crimes, but I don't think that has the impact on the LDS community that, say, for example, a swastika being painted on a synagogue has on the Jewish community, or like happened here in Utah, some folks from Wyoming targeting people coming out of a gay bar. I don't think the impact of that on the gay community is the same as the church being burned in the other community. So, for example, when I heard about that story, my thought wasn't, "Oh, I'm next." Right, it wasn't an intimidation factor.
So you're not equating
right
violence against gay people with what's happening in religious communities, for example.
Yeah. Again, with some exceptions, because obviously,
sure. No, right,
groups like the Jewish faith have a different kind of history than any other religious faith, really. I mean, you can talk about persecution of the Mormons, but it was just a different level with the Jews.
Yeah.
And so can we think about those things and consider those things as different? I think we can, because I think in reality they are. And so when we're talking about real protections that reflect the real life issues of a large portion of the religious community in Utah, that's what we're talking about. What is it that, whether it be Catholics or Mormons or others, what impacts their day-to-day life and captures the big broad portion of that?
But let's be specific about Utah. I mean, one of the things that people who are working to make that compromise, the Utah Compromise, as you call it, last year for that anti-discrimination bill was carving out all of these exemptions specifically, and this is what bugs a lot of people, is you carved out some very particular exemptions for the LDS Church, Brigham Young University in particular.
Right.
So how is it then that that's not already a balance? How is it that those particular exemptions are, aren't taking into account these concerns by the LDS Church, for example?
Well, I think it's because it doesn't apply to all the possible situations. So it's like saying, why isn't SB 296 sufficient for the LGBT community? Well, because it doesn't address everything that they're concerned about, and okay. It's the same in the other direction.
Are you talking about free speech concerns then, for example? I mean, this is
yeah,
one
thing
that – I think and it's interesting. You look at some liberal groups. They're particularly concerned. The American Civil Liberties Union has been concerned about a lot of these pieces of legislation, and in fact, I think if I understand this right, the only piece of legislation they've supported so far, beyond the Utah one, because there have been some exceptions made, and so the Utah ACLU has been able to sign on in principle to the legislation. But Washington State was the only other state that the ACLU felt comfortable supporting the hate crimes bill up there because they were able to make some exceptions related to free speech. Do you worry about this idea of thought crime and free speech like some do? Are you worried about that part?
Well, I certainly worry about free speech questions. And, you know, I think to their credit, the resolution that accompanies SB 107 or is intended to accompany it is a good step in protecting free speech considerations that you can't simply post on Facebook, for instance, that you support a traditional marriage and it's going to be used against you in a hate crime. You know, it has to be some speech connected directly to the crime and that kind of thing. I think that's a good protection. And I think there's other things you could talk about, but certainly the free speech element is an important part of it. And I guess as an example of, I think, a free speech element in the religious liberty context, that maybe we could have companion legislation trying to create the balance that was akin to the same balance we had last year, is perhaps extra protections for, you know, the Brendan Eich examples, right? Somebody donates to a cause based on their religious beliefs, political cause. And that's used as a reason for firing them, for not promoting them, you know. And I think SB 296 covered a lot of that, but we've heard that there's been some instances even in after 296 of those kinds of things happening. And so I think you could do more there potentially to, again, just create a balance for everybody. Again, I think that is what the fairness to all concept is it's addressing everyone on their own terms and not trying to impose one community's terms on the other and call it good as a balance when it doesn't reflect what they're really concerned about.
Okay, so you think there's an equilibrium at play here?
Yes.
If you pass a hate crimes bill that throws it out of balance. Okay, let's go to the other side then. State Senator LeVar Christensen is proposing a piece of legislation that would give Utah control at the state level over marriage and child welfare and adoption. Essentially, it's a way, I think some argue, to bypass that federal ruling on same-sex marriage.
Right.
You support that?
We don't have a position on that bill, but we have the same concerns that we would have on SB 107.
Because again, that would seem to throw it off. That would seem to throw off the balance. So
right.
It seems in principle you should be.
We have
you should
the same
oppose
concerns.
That.
Yeah. We have the same concerns, definitely.
Why oppose the hate crimes bill and not that one?
Well, because the hate crimes bill had real momentum behind it. We're not convinced that other bill does. And so, you know, a lot of this becomes a question of where is our voice most effectively used and where is it really needed? But again, you know, that bill has a lot of the same questions. And we have a lot of the same questions for that representative. Now, I think the facts of that bill are a little different than you stated. In that the state already has control over adoption and welfare. It's not creating that control. I mean, this is a legal precedent going back, you know, centuries that states have a primary control over domestic relations. But
do you agree with the critics who say it's an effort to sort of bypass the same-sex ruling from the Supreme Court?
No, I don't know that that's the case because I'm not sure that I'm sure. The Obergefell decision didn't make a decision on adoption. So we have to make that decision here in Utah. And some folks would like to say, well, clearly, because gay marriage is legal, therefore it means that you have to treat all married couples the same when it comes to adoption. But that's not what the Supreme Court said in Obergefell. And so now they may say that, and it's completely logical to think that, yeah, they may just say that. But it's not illogical to think they may say something different because it turns out adoption is different than marriage, right? Go figure, right? There's some different context going on there. And so that's why adoption law is different than marriage law. And we'll see how that goes. But again, the same concerns that exist on SB 107 exist in the context of that law, which is creating, in this case, I think it's creating a perception, the political element of the Utah Compromise, that we're going back on that to one-sided bills on one side or the other, rather than kind of holding ourselves to the same standard that we achieved last year of moving it forward together. And that means that both sides are going to have to give a little and probably not be happy with everything the other side is getting, whether you're on the religious liberty side of things or the gay rights side of things. But that's what compromise is.
Let me ask you this finally. Do you have any practical concerns about hate crimes legislation? I mean, we're going to get to these in a moment with another guest on the program, but this idea of whether or not they actually work to deter violence, for example, that's one of the arguments, and whether or not they're really fair in terms of criminal justice reform, that they impose penalties unduly on the poor, on racial minorities, for example. I mean, do you have a perspective on that in terms of hate crimes?
Whether hate crimes impose undue penalties on
whether the poor? They disproportionately are imposed upon people who are minorities, for example, or who are poor. I mean, that's one of the arguments that I guess I'm just getting at. Do you also have practical concerns? Let's just go to the one. Do they deter violence against LGBT people? I mean, are they even effective in that score?
I don't know. I haven't looked deeply into the research on that, but it's a valid question to answer. Certainly, it's an important question to answer.
Yeah. You think the bill's dead? Are you counting votes too up there?
Well, we had an interview with the Tribune on this with Senator Cardin. We just disagree. He said he believes the bill's on a clear path to passage.
He said it was.
It was.
He says it's not now. So what do you think? Is he right?
Well, I don't think he was right about it in the first place. And from our perspective and from the sources we had in the legislature, I think it was on a path to not pass. And, you had comments from the Senate president actually saying that the church statement probably only swayed a couple votes. And so if it's on a clear path to passage and this is the game changer, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And this is the Senate president. He's the one who would know, you think, more than anyone else. And if it's not having that dramatic an impact on changing votes, then it probably says something about where the bill was headed in the first place.
It's Derek Monson. He's the director of public policy for the Sutherland Institute here in Salt Lake City. Joined us in the studio. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are discussing a hate crimes bill at the Utah legislature. The idea of the legislation, according to State Senator Stephen Urquhart, who sponsored the measure, was to impose more rigorous penalties for people who target victims because of certain biases, among them sexual orientation and race, those kinds of things. But critics, including the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, apparently say that a bill like this would upset a balance the state achieved with last year's anti-discrimination law. So we're talking about this piece of legislation. Clifford Roske is with us now, professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. He's a member of the Equality Utah Advisory Board. He helped draft Senator Urquhart's legislation, and he testified on behalf of the bill. And, Professor, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here, Doug.
Well, I guess I want to – I'm not sure how much you want to talk about the LDS Church's involvement, and believe me, I won't ask you too much about it. But I think the principal question raised by Senator Urquhart is – first of all, what effect do you think it's having, going to have, on the legislation? Urquhart says snuffed out. He thinks it's dead because of the church's involvement. But more broadly to the question of whether or not the church being involved subverted the democratic process by seeing that the legislation was headed for passage, jumped in, and killed it. What do you have a comment on that?
I mean, in terms of the prospects for passage, I'm not an elected official. Don't have any inside knowledge there. I can tell you that every conversation that we had with stakeholders went very well prior to the church's press release. We have an incredibly broad coalition, essentially unlimited. So we have the Utah Sentencing Commission, the Utah Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice, all of the district attorneys of Utah, and members of every other faith group in the state, women's groups, disability groups, the NAACP. So certainly conversations were going well. And a 5-1 vote, you know, that was three Republican votes coming out.
This
of
was a hearing that
The Senate Judiciary to bring the bill out with a favorable recommendation by 5-1 vote is a very favorable result.
So another thing that's interesting is what Senator Urquhart said seemed to be – what you're hearing from some critics is that, look, we – okay. From the perspective of those who like, for example, the LDS Church. Look, we had – with this anti-discrimination bill, we had an agreement. Let's leave things as they are. And you, Senator Urquhart, by proposing this piece of legislation, you're changing the deal. We had a deal. You wouldn't propose anything new, and that we should stay pat. That there's a kind of equilibrium here. Let's leave it as it is. Was there such an agreement, or at least a conversation about that kind of an agreement? I mean, you were involved in the conversations last year.
I certainly was. Well, we've already heard Senator Urquhart speak to this, and when Gail Ruzicka made the claim, she conceded that the promise never came from Senator Urquhart. So. We have to take him at his word. I can't imagine Senator Urquhart agreeing to that deal. What I can say, at the time I was the board chair of Equality Utah and I was deeply involved in the negotiations, if anyone had said the deal is that you can get this and then we'll keep you in a little box and you'll never get anything else, we would have rejected that deal out of hand. That's undemocratic. Every Utahn has the right to seek basic equal protections under the law at the Capitol. There's no deal where you can't come back. That's just not the way democracy works.
All right. Well, let's move aside from politics and talk about some of the particulars of this bill. And it's one of the questions that I posed to Stephen Urquhart. What's the problem you're trying to fix? Essentially, what you're saying is there's no teeth in the current hate crimes legislation. There are a few pieces here, but they don't really do much, essentially.
That's right. We have a few statutes that say hate crimes in the title. And as the Utah courts have said, they seem to be intended to target hate crimes. But then when you read the text of the laws, there's no reference to hatred or bias or prejudice. There's no reference to any particular characteristics that are protected. It's really not a hate crimes law at all. So there are hate crimes laws in almost every state at the federal level, and they all look like Senator Urquhart's bill, except for Utah's.
Derek Monson mentioned earlier in his op-ed piece, which I was mentioning, he said that the bill should include specifics that protect religious people, and these should include specifics such as barring prosecutors from using good faith religious expression as evidence of a hate crime. Like, for example, and this was one of the things he mentioned, like social media statements where someone supports traditional marriage. You want to say something about that? The specifics that he says need to be in place to balance religious liberty against the rights of gay people, for example?
I mean, the first thing to point out here is that this bill protects religious freedoms. It adds new protections for religious freedoms that don't exist. Even just the bill itself is protecting the religious freedom of victims of hate crimes. We have to remember that LDS people were fleeing hate crimes when they founded this state, when they founded BYU. That's the history of this state. And even since the passage of Prop 8, as we've heard, chapels have been burned in retaliation for that. So this bill would make sure that, you know, it's as the senator said, when you put a swastika on a synagogue, you're defacing the property, but you're also threatening the Jewish community. Those are really two crimes. There's a graffiti crime and there's a threat. And by punishing the threat, too, you protect the religious freedom of the people who've been targeted. I'm not sure that I understand this idea that LDS people don't care when chapels get burned. I've never heard anyone say that before. That doesn't strike me as plausible.
So then how do you understand the argument? Essentially, that's not what they're arguing then. What they're worried about is that you're giving these – and this comes up all the time when you're listening to concerns about hate crimes legislation – special protection, that this adds special protections to gay people. And that seems to be the thing that really rankles, I guess.
You know, this argument came up last year as well, and it was really an important moment when we were able to clarify that it's a misunderstanding. When you say you can't discriminate based on race, that means you can't discriminate against someone because they're black or because they're white or because of, you know, the color of their skin. It protects people of all races, all religions. Everyone has a sexual orientation. If someone were to beat you up because you're heterosexual, that would be a hate crime under this law. There's no special protections here.
I want to get to some of the there are a lot of, as you know, some progressive groups who oppose hate crimes legislation. And they have particular reasons for it. And I wanted to go through some of those because I wanted to give you a chance to talk about them. This idea that hate crimes, for example, prevent violence to LGBT people is a myth. That's part of the suggestion. And they say that these groups that tend to oppose hate crimes legislation are easy to demonize. You know, they're homophobic or they're really conservative. But really when it comes right down to it, practically hate crimes legislation doesn't really work, for example. Let's start with one of these issues, the idea of whether or not there's any evidence to suggest that a hate crimes bill or hate crimes law would deter violence against LGBT people. Do we know?
So obviously one of the purposes of our criminal justice system is to attempt to deter crimes, right? To give people strong reasons not to want to commit crimes. There has been a debate for decades, for example, about the death penalty and whether it actually deters crime. It's certainly more punishment than life imprisonment, but does it actually have a greater deterrent effect?
Yeah, and does somebody thinking, somebody who's going to commit this horrible crime, do they think, I better not do this because I could be killed?
Right, and that may happen and it may not happen. We don't really know. There's a debate about it. But it's the premise of our criminal justice system that when you increase the punishment, you increase the deterrent effect. And it's sort of odd to pick on hate crimes in particular as the one example where there might not be a deterrent effect. If that's true, it would be true everywhere. But it's important to understand that deterrence is only one purpose of our criminal justice system. Justice, right? Expressing the community's condemnation of particular kinds of conduct. When someone threatens the LDS community or the Jewish community or the African American community deliberately by doing something like burning a cross on their lawn and saying, get out of the neighborhood, it would be nice if the hate crimes penalty deterred that conduct. That's certainly what we hope. But even if it didn't, it's important for the government to make the statement that that's inappropriate conduct and it deserves punishment and the people who've been victimized deserve to be protected.
Is part of this just punitive?
Well, punitive, it's punishment, right? When someone does something that they don't deserve to do and they harm another innocent human being, yes, the government's normal response is to punish that person. Yeah. Now, you could call that vengeance, but most people would just call that justice.
Right. Some liberal critics of hate crimes legislation say these laws are, and this was something that I just mentioned briefly to Derek Monson, it's not something that he is terribly concerned about. That is whether these laws are fair and just, whether they disproportionately are used against poor people and people of color. That didn't seem to be the thing that concerned the LDS Church, for example. But to that concern by some, what do you say to that? Is there something to it? I mean, how do you react?
I mean, the country is having a very lively and engaging conversation right now about our criminal justice system and whether we're putting people in prison for too long, particularly for victimless crimes like drug possession. It's important to understand that this bill and hate crimes laws don't apply to victimless crimes. We're talking about deliberate attacks on individuals and their property. They're just not victimless. Indeed, the whole point of the proposal is that there's one victim and then there's a whole community that is deliberately being victimized. So that's a pretty different situation. As to whether or not the laws are disproportionately used against poor people and people of color, there's actually good evidence that hate speech laws on campuses are often used by white students to prosecute people, other students of color. There's no evidence that that's true of hate crimes. We are all victims of hate crimes, but disproportionately the victims are members of racial minorities and religious minorities.
To this question that comes up from time to time, some progressive groups like the ACLU, this is problematic for free speech, and that you could effectively be in some ways criminalizing thought. The argument is that, you know, your opinions may be hateful, but that shouldn't be a crime. What do you make of that?
This is a really important consideration, and it's very important to clarify something that makes this proposal from Senator Urquhart different than really almost any other one. We've been working with the ACLU of Utah from the beginning of this project.
Because they're worried about that point.
Because they're worried, and so is Equality Utah. So are all the members of this coalition that want to see an effective hate crimes law. And so we looked around for a model that the ACLU could support because it provided special protections for the defendants, not just the victims' freedoms, but the defendants' freedoms of speech and association. And that's Senate Joint Resolution 13. There's a separate piece of legislation and their companion bills. And what it says is that anything you've ever said in the past, before the crime, any group that you're a member of, that's not evidence against you. The only evidence against you is really what you've said to the victim about this crime. That's what makes the distinction between a normal crime and a hate crime, is what did you say to the victim?
So do you think in some ways other pieces of legislation, hate crimes legislation, are flawed in that sense, that maybe they should be updated to take those things into account? Or is that even considered problematic in terms of the way they're prosecuted in those other states? Do we know?
We know that constitutionally you don't need this language. The Supreme Court has upheld a hate crimes law that didn't have these protections. And the reason was quite simple. And in fact, the Deseret News 25 years ago endorsed the same principle. Look, hate crimes laws don't apply to speech. They apply to crimes, actions. When you cross from speech to a threat, we all recognize that that's a violation of the criminal law. And so it's a little hard to conceptualize what the free speech concern is in general about the laws. Is it that you are scared to say something because you're planning to commit a crime and you don't want your speech to be used against you? That's a kind of odd free speech concern. But we did take it into account.
I'm confused why there was a separate resolution and a bill. Did they come together, or did the resolution come because there were concerns expressed later?
No, the two things were actually originally contained in the same piece of legislation. This is one of these wonky technicalities.
Kind of arcane, procedural things.
When you change the rules of evidence, you need a separate resolution. That's all.
Okay. There's another part to this, and I wanted to ask you about that these kinds of laws could criminalize, and I think you've sort of already spoken to this, but I want to – this seems like a real bugaboo for people who are worried about this, especially the LDS Church, that these kinds of laws could criminalize the expression of these deeply held moral and religious beliefs, that they in some way quell religious expression. I'm not sure what they mean by that, clearly the LDS Church is trying to figure out what to do about religious liberty and how that plays out in the wake of the Supreme Court ruling. What do you make of that concern? Because it does come up.
I really don't think that we can say that that's the church's concern. They've never expressed that concern. In 1992, the Deseret News endorsed hate crimes legislation, said passed the bill, criticized the legislature for amending it. In 2003, the church said, we are not opposed to hate crimes legislation. I would be very surprised if they have changed their minds on that. And I think it's this special resolution that we have that really just destroys that concern. I mean, that concern is no longer – you can say anything you want. You can think anything you want. You can be a member of any church you want. Just don't hit somebody. Don't burn their property. And if you do, the only evidence that could be used against you is what you said during the crime to the victim, the fact that you're a member of a particular church, the fact that you indeed are a member of the Nazi Party. You have a swastika tattoo. None of that can be evidence against you under this law.
So why did the church issue this statement? Why are they opposing this piece of legislation? If they in the past have said in principle we support this, is it – I can't figure it out.
I'm puzzled too.
Okay.
I will say that I have never previously commented on the church's public statements and certainly doctrines. I am not LDS, but many of my family members are active in the church, and I have partnered with the church in the past. I don't think that it can really be a concern about religious liberty for the reasons we've discussed. I have to say, when I saw the church's original statement about bills that alter the balance, I just assumed they couldn't possibly be talking about the hate crimes bill. And it was only when someone called that a spokesperson apparently said, oh, no, we mean to include the hate crimes bill. So I just don't understand how it does anything but give equal treatment for everyone. Fairness for all is the church's framework. It adds new protections for religious victims. It adds new protections for religious defendants that don't exist in the current law.
It's hard to assess what they think because the statement was pretty vague. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. I mean, the original statement didn't mention hate crimes at all.
No. Can I read it, by the way?
Please.
The Utah legislature achieved something extraordinary last year in arriving at legislation that protected both religious liberty rights and LGBT rights. Interests from both ends of the political spectrum are attempting to alter that balance. We believe that the careful balance achieved through being fair to all should be maintained. That's it.
And it's so important to understand that the current law protects no one. So there was actually a case where a court found that a white guy beat up a black girl while yelling racial slurs at her, knocked her to the ground, and the court agreed this is a racially motivated attack. But Utah's law doesn't mention racially motivated attacks. It's not just LGBT people who aren't being protected. It's not even just people of faith. It's everyone. And the notion that we can't protect black people, Jewish people, gay people, transgender people, and LDS people at the same time, unless, as the Sutherland Institute says, you give us something that we really want, not protecting our churches from being arson, you know, but something else. We need something else. Honestly, that just sounds like political extortion. It's not a compromise at all.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have anything to say about Senator LeVar Christensen's bill up there at the legislature? I have a sense you've looked at it, but I don't want to put you on the spot to assess it yet.
I've looked at it, and it's difficult to say whether it's a meaningless message bill or whether it's actually an attempt to roll back basic fundamental rights that have been upheld by the United States Supreme Court.
Was it a response to the hate crime legislation? I've heard it described that way, but I have no way of knowing.
I really don't know. There are certainly a lot of very bad bills that are very deliberately targeting LGBT people this year. He has another bill that he hasn't released in which he said to Equality Utah, my religious liberty bill would take care of this once and for all, and if you don't drop your hate crimes bill, I will declare war and release my bill.
Clifford Roski, he's a professor of law at the University of Utah, member of the Equality Utah Advisory Board, joined us here in the studio. Professor, thanks very much.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson and Sophie Sirwa. The show directed by Tim Slover. Josh Weathers produces Video West. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.